The following is a meeting with disciples with His Holiness Srila Satsarupa Das Goswami, given on July 18, 1992, in Wicklow, Ireland.
I have some questions that you've given me previously, and I've looked them over. In some cases, I've done a little research, so I'll try to answer them. I hope it'll be interesting and helpful. When I finish discussing any particular question, before I go to another one, you ask any further questions or discussion about it. This first one, the devotee actually wrote me a letter asking me for some advice in a particular situation he was in. And he was a disciple of mine, which is, in most cases, the relationship here. Then, broadening that the topic of asking the spiritual master to help make a decision, and we have this question about decision making. In our present state of flux in Ireland, many decisions arise, whether to live in or out of a temple, choice of spiritual master, service, etc. Is there a need to always act? God helps those who help themselves. Or can one patiently work on looking for indications and guidelines? How much should one rely on the guru for such decisions? And what kind of help do you feel most confident in giving to your disciples? That's a very thoughtful question. I'm not going to suggest some original method of how to make decisions, but some thoughts on the matter. Of course, as devotees, we should be striving to meet the criteria of trying to satisfy Krishna. Should I do this or should I do that? Should I get married or should I remain brahmachari? Should I move to this part of the country or that part of the country? Or the questions he has, which are very serious questions. So that we should always be asking, what does Krishna want? Now, that doesn't immediately solve the question, because we may not know what Krishna wants, or even if we did, we wouldn't be faced with whether we could do it. But still, that should be there, even though there are some difficulties in that. As we do whatever our method is for trying to decide, that should be there. Well, what does Krishna want? What would be pleasing to God? Because I'm His eternal servant. If I try to go against Him, also just in plain terms of practical matters, it's not going to work. You just there's a Taoist saying that don't try to go against the way things are, or all you'll do is create resistance, wear yourself out. So we personalize that understanding by knowing that I'll not be happy unless I can actually fulfill the will of Krishna for me. Then it becomes a search for what does Krishna want and how can I do it. But that may be a little lofty for us, and we still have to go over pros and cons of a decision specifically. One thing is that it's not always just a dramatic thing that we come to the crossroads. And that's it. Now, within within 15 seconds we have to decide. But actually, every minute we're already making decisions. We are going in a certain direction, and if with some self-examination, we will see that we're already deciding. Take a theoretical example that a brahmachari is at a point where he's trying to think, well, should I get married? And specifically, there's a girl who he may be thinking of or even associating with properly, but in some association in his temple. So he may not even notice how an attachment is developing. And then he suddenly finds himself, I'm in a crisis, I have to make a decision. He may discover, as he starts to think about it, think, well, should I get married or not? And then it may hit him as an emotion that I'm already past decision. I've already decided. Because by increments, he has emotionally committed himself in such a way that now when he consults himself, he sees in terms of gut reaction where he's already strongly headed. And by action that he's taken, he's already done it. It's like if you sign a contract, business contract, then you leave the office and you're thinking, was that the best thing or not? Should I have done that or not? You can think that over, but you can't go back. You can't go back. You've already done it. So this is not a bad thing, but we should be aware that of these minute by minute, or day by day at least, decisions for in a certain direction. To try to make this more clear, let's look at some of the decisions to be made that have been mentioned here. One is, what is the choice of a spiritual master? It's been said that this is as important or more important a decision to make than the choice of a spouse, because that's a very important decision. When you decide to get married, who to marry. So similarly, when you decide to take the spiritual life and you understand you have to accept a spiritual master, it's very important. So Prabhupada has dealt with this question, and he said that the question was put in a different way, that how can an ignorant person who doesn't know, how can he understand who is a perfect person, representative of Krishna? So Prabhupada said, therefore, you have to know something about it, about what is a spiritual master before you're going to go find a spiritual master. And he gave the example, if you're trying to decide on going to a school, or parents may be trying to decide what school for their child, or you should find out something about schools. So I think the principle here is to find out as much as possible. And this would be a way of decision making. Otherwise, if you go into trying to pick a spiritual master, just, well, here's a personality, which one? On what basis are you going to make a decision? So in spiritual life, this is always advisable. Try to find out as much as you can. So you read Prabhupada's books, read the scriptures. What is a spiritual master? Who needs a spiritual master? And so on. What is Krishna conscious philosophy? What kind of guidance do you need? And so on and so on. And the more you learn, then you're very much advanced in picking, in making that decision. And sometimes, even despite these different things, you're really faced with some like emotional crisis of which can be exciting also, not necessarily bad, that I feel I'm on the verge, I really have to decide which way am I going to go now. now I can feel some momentousness in my life at this point. I really have to decide. So at times like that, then, although you've already been preparing yourself by reading about Krishna consciousness and practicing, now you should intensify that to find out what Krishna wants. Not exactly on the level like we read in the life of St. Francis of Assisi, he just on a few occasions just open the Bible, read something, okay, that's it, and take that course. Not exactly like that, but a little like that, in that let me see what Prabhupada is saying. And I've had that experience of going through a period of trying to decide something and then intensely reading and trying to, and then seeing again and again some direction that it may not even have been, I may have been going a little bit the other way, then again and again Prabhupada is saying, this is the way, this is the way. And then it was hard to, because hearing it at that time, it seems to be a little providential that when you're really asking him to tell you what to do, he keeps telling you, do it this way, do it this way. Live in or out of a temple, choice of service. I'll get back to those. This other point, a personal point, how, what kind of help do I feel most confident in giving? It's a presumptuous position to take, to give people advice. A lot of people, they get paid for doing it in different fields. They give advice. It's kind of like a high-level occupation, like a remember, I wonder, our godbrother Atreya Rishi, he was in the business field, speculation, accounting, business management, but he had reached such a sophisticated level after going to Harvard Business School and having experience and everything, that all he did was he would hear some problem and give advice, and people would pay for that, or a firm would pay for that. But it's presumptuous, because you have to know all the ramifications in a world which is always changeable and hazardous, and then there's even the factor that you may give advice which may be objectively sound and based on a lot of principles, but it's not, that person doesn't like it, and later he'll never agree that was good advice, even if everyone else would say, well, you gave good advice, but he'll say, I was given bad advice. So it's and nowadays in the court system there's malpractice. Even there's been some cases of ministers being brought to court for malpractice when all they did was give something that hadn't before been under the jurisdiction of the law, saying you gave bad advice if you gave spiritual advice. Now that also may be legally entangling. So it's presumptuous and it's dangerous. But not only the spiritual master, but friends do this. But I think we should be cautious about giving advice and be aware, especially when there's a lot of trust involved. So this is a personal question, and I've gone through my own changes in this, and tend not to give so much advice in terms of relative things and very particular things in people's lives. I would like to say that I'm trying to train people who come to me for advice or my disciples, train them how to think for themselves. But that's a very ambitious thing. I'm not sure that I can live up to that, but I like the sound of that. Training people to make decisions for themselves. That sounds like a very high order of training. I hesitate to say that I am doing that because I don't have any special step-by-step program to do that. I hope that if I can set a halfway decent example of practicing Krishna consciousness and making decisions, that there's an example to follow. And so that doesn't mean, oh, now I should, my spiritual master, he took sannyas when he was 32 years old, so I should do that. I should write books. No, but you can pick up a definite consistency of instructions and a kind of attitude towards practicing Krishna consciousness from behavior also, and we do. So, even indirectly, but one has to be sensitive and submissive to pick up advice in an indirect way like that. But the question is, what do I feel confident? I feel confident in that after, one isn't sure even about one's own life, that am I doing the right thing? But we put so much thought into your own family or your own life. So that's like the most researched and carefully decisions you've made. So you feel confident that, well, that's about the best I can do based on whatever realization I have and trying to be faithful and renounce. That's the best I can do. So you feel if there's any confidence, it would be that you can draw something from my own life. But if someone says, should I live inside or outside the temple? If you just shoot from the hip, oh, you should live inside the temple. It's maya to live outside the temple. Or should I get married or not? Oh, don't get married. Those are just based on some dogma or just on an impersonal kind of a approach and so on. I like to give spiritual advice directly of the sort that I've been giving since I came to Ireland, that you should read Prabhupada's books, you should chant Hare Krishna. This I feel very confident on, because we're together on the basis of Krishna consciousness. I'm not an expert in anything. If I'm an expert in anything, supposedly it's in following Srila Prabhupada, and everyone here is serious to do that. So you're asking me sometimes for advice. So therefore, in spiritual life, these things, Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu Smaranam, they're said to be the most important thing. So I certainly feel confident in saying that. If someone says, I'm really having trouble getting along with other devotees, or when I get sick, it depresses me in Krishna consciousness, or this or that. So I feel confident in saying that if you chant Hare Krishna and hear about Krishna, your miseries in the other areas will reduce. But at the same time, I try to give some suggestions. And maybe it's not exactly advice. I try to remain a friend or develop a friendship with the disciples to help them go through their changes and help form, according to the degree that they're asking and the way they're asking, help form an attitude towards making those decisions. As I said, the decisions are made regularly, every day. And then one wakes up and finds out, oh, I'm already committed in this way. So the more we have contact, and it appears that we're just talking, not about whether to do this or that, but we're just talking back and forth, then I'm giving some input in a way that I feel confident about. Not that all of a sudden I'm hit, should I do this or I do that? I don't know. But we've been talking about it because we have a relationship. And then when it comes up, almost some cases nothing needs to be said, or you make your decision. Also confident because of a relationship that I won't reject you because you chose this instead of this. You say, well, my spiritual master, he's really going to reject me because I decided to have to get married, or I decided I had to live outside the temple. But there'll be a relationship and such that it's assumed that, all right, you decided one way or another. But the main thing we've always been saying is that you should practice spiritual life. So now practice it in this way. What's the big deal that you chose this one instead of that one? Unless it's something that's really so obviously not a good idea, then one tries. And it's like Prabhupada says, you see a man on the roof, and he's flying a kite, and he's backing up, and he's backing up, he's going to fall off the roof. So you, unsolicited, you shout him some advice. Look out, don't fall. And sometimes he's he says, as in that story, he looks down and says, "Why have you disturbed my kite flying? Leave me alone." He doesn't appreciate. But you have to do that. You have to say, "Look out, look out." So, any further discussion on that point? Good topic, how to make decisions on your own or getting advice.
Yeah. Overall picture, sometimes, you know, for myself anyway, you know, I'll head back, as usual, towards my advancement in Krishna consciousness, and sometimes I think that's a good thing. And then I think it's a bad thing, because other people can be very intense. And I wonder, you know, is there any... Could that be an indication of not advancing as you are? You know, you don't seem to worry about it too much. Should it be intense decisions being made all the time?
No, if you're laid back about the right things, it's very good. It's like a sage who's not agitated by all the upheavals that, now this is happening, now that's happening, what are you going to do about this? What is your opinion about that? This is happening to us. But if you have some understanding that this is temporary nature, and that basically God is good, and we have what we need, don't worry, this is very good. It wouldn't be good if it's in the area also of neglecting spiritual life. Like the complacent materialist, he doesn't see the need for taking the spiritual life. He's not afraid of birth and death and so on, as a false complacency. But partly it's just kind of temperaments that we have, but. I think it's good to be not so easily riled up. But we should have a course and be steadily working at it. Then you become peaceful.
What would be helpful? It seems like when we're embroiled in this everyday kind of affairs in our life, the complacency, the thing that seems to go out the window first, if you like, would be the chanting of Hare Krishna, as opposed to, say, paying the bills or whatever. That the bad tendency would to put the kind of the Krishna consciousness on the back burner.
Yeah.
Into the other things first.
So
I'm asking, like, the urgency to see that important thing.
Yeah, well, that's what when in answering Uddhava's question, I was kind of partly imagining a theoretical person who wouldn't worry so much. If it came to it, he wouldn't worry so much about the bills to the point where he thought that I have to engage myself so much to get so much money that this chanting, which was all right when I was younger and I liked to do it, but it's a luxury. And what to speak of hearing about Krishna. He would have the priorities that the money will come. And I'll do like Narada advised Yudhisthira for householders to work, but don't do ugra karma, and don't work more than necessary, but have spiritual life every day, and the money will come. Or at any rate, I just can't give up my spiritual practices. I'll take the reactions. And so he would he would go ahead like that. So the other person, which can be any one of us, gets caught up in the fears and insecurities of coping with day-to-day life in this world, and feels that this takes all my energy and all my thinking. I can't help it. So they're in an unfortunate situation, and should try to think over. I mentioned this in obstacles in the path of devotional service. That one of the obstacles I said was chanting and hearing, and then I explained, well, how is this an obstacle? I said it's the most important thing. So it's an obstacle if it becomes neglected in your life. Then if that happens, you should like look over your life again, and how have you got yourself in that position, and try to make some change so that it's priority again. If you become so materialistic, then it'll be very difficult. You won't see the value of it. But if you're not that, if that hasn't happened, but you just think that you have to neglect it, then you can just try to make up a new game plan for life, which just includes it. And then, you know, if there's not enough money to live in a certain place, a certain standard, then we'll have to live like that. If there's not enough time to do all those other materialistic duties, then what would we do? If we insisted that we would chant, because I want to do this, and lead a more spiritual life, then what does it mean? We'll face the reactions. Then you can plan for it like that, to put it in, if you have a desire to do it. Now, I'm getting in the area where it's personally hard for me to discuss it, except theoretically. I've been fortunate that I don't have so much material responsibility. So I don't want to glibly tell people that they should, what it may sound to them like telling them to neglect their duties. But what I read in the shastras, it's not advice to, you know, advice for sannyasis. Here's this section. It's not. It's even specifically advice for grihasthas. And it says that, keep a balance. You're a grihastha. You have to do other things, take care of these other things. But don't let it lose balance so that you don't have spiritual life. And when you see that it does, then adjust it in the favor of the spiritual life. That's your duty. You're a grihastha, you're not a grihamedi. You have to plan for yourself and your family that they're getting Krishna consciousness. And if you give them some material standard, but not that, then you're not a good provider. I remember very early someone asked, when we didn't know much what Krishna consciousness was, a guest, 26th Second Avenue, said, if someone wants to follow this really full-time and dedicated, can they also be a married man? And Prabhupada said, unless you practice Krishna consciousness, you cannot be a bona fide married man, he said. And he was explaining what it means to be a grihastha, to take care, responsibility. It primarily means to, like a guru position, to give them spiritual life, but plus he has to give them material facilities too. So it's a high order, and he may have to trim down his spiritual activities, but if they disappear, then he's not a good husband or not a good wife, simply coping like everybody else. But as I say, I'm just going on what I've heard in the philosophy, and that's how I go in my own life, and with some faith, with not like a guarantee from a bank or anything, but some faith that there's some illusory anxiety that the shastras say, and a kind of illusory anxiety that the materialist gets himself into, thinking, unless I work hard all day and night, I won't get enough to eat. Prabhupada says all he eats is two or four chapatis, but he thinks that actually he has to work just to get that. He said, but he doesn't have to. And then gives the example that the animals, the elephant, he gets so much, but without that, but we think like that. This is the principle, and then how to apply it, that may take actual experience as a grihastha. If I said too much or too specifically, it may sound naive, but you should, you should take that principle and say, this is the principle. Now, it's not up to my spiritual master, or it's not up to Narada Muni to apply it in 1992 for me. I have to apply it. That's my business. But I want to follow this somehow or other, and then try to do that. That was an example that just came to my mind. There was a devotee in Spain, and he had a big business, incense and other things. And he was very generous. He was like supporting the whole temple, because he was like part of the temple management. But he was obviously a talented money maker, and so he had a business all over Spain. He was developing and developing. But it got so entangling for him that his own spiritual life was just about gone. So then he just made a decision that I'm just going to reduce this business to just take care of my family. And because I want to be part of the temple life and the preaching activity. So he did that, and the temple was disappointed. But he continued his integral role in the society of devotees, but was able to take care of himself. He just saw himself going down the drain in the name of this wonderful countrywide business. That's just one example of something that seemed to be a practical step that one might take. In Prabhupada's case, it was like he just tried, and then he just couldn't make. His businesses kept failing. So he finally became like a pauper and left his family, not because he couldn't support them, but because they didn't like his emphasis on turning to preaching. That was an example where it seemed like Krishna made the decision. But obviously, the person, Prabhupada, he was so intent that I'm not going to give up this Bhaktivedanta magazine, and I'm not going to give up trying to follow my spiritual master's order. If I can, I'll make money. But if I can, I'm not just going to do like they say. Spending a lot of time on one question, but that's all right. Yeah.
Guru Maharaj, you were saying that, like in connection to, let's say, moving outside or getting married, that someone, they may have gone so far that they asked the question, but the decision was already made.
Yeah.
In their heart or in their mind.
They just have to notice it.
That's right. But in one sense, as you say, it's not necessarily a bad thing, because you can live outside and practice Krishna consciousness, or you can get married and practice Krishna consciousness.
Yeah.
But sometimes, maybe we've let our Krishna consciousness slip, and we've come to a stage where it may be something that you can't engage in Krishna consciousness. The decision is already made.
Yeah.
That you want to get into Maya, and you say, well, I shouldn't do that, but it's already, your heart has already decided, or your mind or your senses.
Well, that means trouble. Yeah, we're going to have to pay for it, but it doesn't mean that we can't pull out, you know, whatever it is. We have to, if it's something really bad and we realize it and we've gone so far that, say, we've fallen down from the principles, then what do? Then you act according to Vaishnava life and Vaishnava etiquette. Or say, I tried not to commit the first offense in chanting to offend devotees. Gradually, I thinking bad, and then I really offend somebody, and it's too late. So then I ask forgiveness from that person, and try not to do it again. Yes, so that happens. That and the advice is to be to try to notice these things as soon as possible and act as soon as possible. If it's going in a very bad direction. The other, you may notice it little by little, something like it's indicating something in your direction that that it looks like maybe I ought to live outside the temple because of this experience I have and that experience. You just notice it and it doesn't, you can just like say, that looks like me. I guess that looks like what I am. Well, maybe not. Maybe that's not me. It's not inevitable. It's not a terrible thing. It's sort of a neutral thing. And after a while, you may get to think, well, why am I resisting this? Why am I trying to suppress this? This is the kind of person I am. I keep coming up with this particular desire for a kind of service or whatever it is. Might as well go with it now and put my energy into it, and I'll really be satisfied. But the other one, when you notice it in the early stages, then that's the only time that you can stop those things. So this is a bad thing. This would be very harmful for my spiritual life. And then stop it. Otherwise, you can't stop it. It's too late. But then you have to take your heart off the attachment. I don't think these things nothing is so fatal that you can't be excused by Krishna and forgiven if you go... go before him.
And one time you gave the example of and used the scriptural injunction. There was a devotee who said, all the morning ablutions I forget about you.
Oh, yeah.
All this and that. And you know, there's lots of different things he said that he forgot. So long as I'm engaged in Krishna service, then I'm really happy.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that's the way that you wanted to live as well.
Madhavendra Puri's prayer.
That's right, yeah. And I was just thinking about that that's really the ideal. But sometimes when we're doing something, we might feel really good about it and it seems to be the right thing. Like sometimes I personally feel like, yeah, this is really the right thing that I'm doing. But then someone else might say, this is just an old passion. You know, it seems to be. Whereas that may be right, actually, because my level of really doing what I want to do may not be such a high level. Mm. So, I'm just wondering about how to, you know, to question further, how to increase one's level of getting.
It sounds like you're also bringing up a topic of a person getting to know himself and deciding how he's going to serve. And then balancing the advice of others with assurance that he knows best what he's doing. And like we had a caution would be, as Krishna gives, don't prematurely renounce. The Madhavendra Puri's prayer is that he renounces everything. And what makes it so surprising and refreshing and radical is that he gives up even religious duties. The things he mentions, the Brahmin, he should bathe 3 times a day, he should say his prayers. Oh, he said, I'm goodbye to this, goodbye to that. I don't need any of this. And everyone will criticize me and say I'm a fool, but I don't care. I'm just going to worship Govinda. And I don't care what my in-laws will criticize me, and the people will say I'm too proud, and so on. He's so convinced of what he's going to do. But it's full of renunciation. So... if prematurely we renounce family duties and financial responsibilities, that can be done at a certain point. And like in the scriptures, we have these examples of people just walking out on all these things and becoming a renounced devotee. But Krishna criticizes that if you do it prematurely, because you walk out of one scene and in the name of being a sadhu, but you still have those desires in your heart, so then it's even worse. Then you find another woman and another way to make money and this and that. And becomes scandalous. So we can't just walk out on things that are premature renunciation. But, like, this idea that this is what I like to do, this is the way I like to serve Krishna, and people even laughing at you or saying, oh no, that's no good, that's the mode of passion, or that's not what Prabhupada wants. There has to reach a stage where you know that this is what I'm going to do, and as this is laughable and faulty, so is anything else I would do, and others' service, I want to look on their life favorably, but there's probably, they can be criticized too. This is what I want to do for Krishna. And then you go ahead and do it. So I caution that we can't do that prematurely, but getting back to that thing about myself and offering advice and everything, it's something that I've been trying to deal with for years and coming to some progress with, and I think it's a very a challenging thing for everyone, and there's no easy way out of it. You can't really say for sure that now I'm completely right and nobody can criticize me. I know what I'm doing, but still you start to know and take advice that encourages you in that direction from those who will support you in it, and especially if you start to get some good results from it. But this is a desirable and important part of life as a devotee, to get this confidence in your way and to see the imperfections in it, that it's passionate. And this may always, everyone has some fault until you become perfect, so this may always be your fault that you're passionate, or someone's fault is always something. So he accepts that, but he says, "But I'm going to serve, and I'll try to purify myself by this particular service." And so we hope that he doesn't make some big mistake, but that he makes the best service he can in the way that he has decided to serve Krishna. Does that make sense? Or clear? Yeah. Prabhupada was, they thought he was foolish. Old man, wanting to go to America, he's got no money. Don't Swamiji. He asked Samaji Maharaji, just stay in India. You can write your books here. You may die over there. And the people in America, they're not favorable to this kind of thing. The weather is not good. Just don't go, Swamiji. No, I must go. That was seemed like a folly. But that's how great things happen, when people do something that's not what everybody does, and which is somehow a calling that they're receiving, which inspires them with a great desire to serve Krishna in that way. And when they do it in a selfless way, to try to make themselves an instrument to serve Krishna. How to relate to the spiritual master? I think I can answer that very directly by going on to the next. There's a couple of questions about that. One is, should we hanker for the personal association of the guru? Did Srila Prabhupada really say, personal association is for fools? I have also heard the statement that the perfection of the eyesight is to see the spiritual master. Is that so? I think we should hanker for personal association of the guru, but we have to understand what is association. And as with any Vaishnava association, it doesn't mean only coming together. Just like we, all our bodies, we've come together from different parts of the country today. We're here. But we could, now that we're here, we're associating already physically, but we could do nonsense, or we can spend our time in Krishna Katha, Krishna instructions. So the real association is churning the nectar of Krishna consciousness and getting benefit for our lives from that. So that can be enhanced by coming together physically, but it can also be done, you mentioned letters, and by hearing talks and thinking of instructions, being very personal for the way that person is teaching, following what he's saying, and trying to, and finding it very inspiring, then you are associating personally with that person. Prabhupada did say that personal association is for fools in one letter to a devotee who wanted to leave his duties and come and be with Prabhupada. The idea that you always have to be with the spiritual master and you don't understand the essence, which is to follow his instructions wherever you are, and that he lives with you in the heart. But this is, even that saying, devotees would affectionately counter it and say, well, if that's true, then I'm a fool because I want to be with him. I want to be with Prabhupada, so I'm a fool. Anyway, you're supposed to be a fool. So let us be fools and associate with the spiritual master. We say we need it. That can be countered like that. So that's partly a reply to that. And then this other question is something that I wrote in Prabhupada Meditations 2, which had a heading, Awkward Times. It told different examples of how either I felt awkward in Prabhupada's presence or other devotees did. You seem to draw a correlation between feeling awkward in Prabhupada's presence with having an undeveloped relationship with Prabhupada. My question is, I often feel awkward in your presence, but I have up until now cherished that. It's helped me to try to fulfill the injunctions such as, 1, always appearing as a fool in front of the spiritual master, and 2, not seeing the spiritual master as an ordinary person. Well, I can understand that not feeling, quote, awkward, unquote, with the spiritual master doesn't necessarily mean you can't fulfill the above criteria. Do you think that as long as a disciple does feel awkward with the spiritual master, his relationship is undeveloped? No, I don't think that. That feeling awkward means that you don't have a good relationship with your guru. Of course, it all depends on what we mean by awkward. If it means that we don't feel too familiar and that we don't see him just like an equal or ordinary person, then that kind of awkwardness is good. But I did mention in the Prabhupada meditations how the awkwardness in the beginning was part of an undeveloped relationship. We didn't know what to say to him. And we felt so much distance by, he had a different culture, and he spoke differently, and then we didn't trust him. Well, he's a guru, and he wants you to surrender, become his disciple, and I'm not sure I actually trust him that much. And if I get into this, I'll have to worship Krishna. So the awkwardness can be due to not being developed. And in that case, a friendship. The spiritual master-disciple is a friendly relationship as well as authority or father and son, father and daughter. It's also friendship, and the friendship develops. I have an example of someone explaining his relationship with Prabhupada. I just happened to be reading it because I'm preparing for a seminar on Prabhupada. This was by George Harrison. He talks about first meeting Prabhupada. And then after that, Prabhupada just looked like I thought he would. I had a mixed feeling of fear and awe about meeting him. That's what I liked about later on, after meeting him more. I felt that he was just more like a friend. I felt relaxed. It was much better than at first, because I hadn't been able to tell what he was saying, and I wasn't sure if I was too worldly to even be there. But later I relaxed and felt much more at ease with him, and he was very warm toward me. He wouldn't talk differently to me than to anybody else. He was always just speaking about Krishna, and it was coincidental who happened to be there. Whenever you saw him, he would always be the same. It wasn't like one time he would tell you to chant the Hare Krishna mantra, and the next time say, oh, no, I made a mistake. So that's like, this is an example of a developing relationship in which the awkwardness was lessened. So I thought that would partly answer your question. But you asked about what to say in letters and so on. Some devotees, they think that they have they can't write a letter, or they finally write it and they say, I've been trying to write this letter for a year and I rip up all the drafts. This time I'm just going to go ahead. I don't care if it's not any good or not. Here goes. I see that often. It seems like I have a real writer's block in writing a letter to the spiritual master, or maybe to anybody. And part of it is this image that they want to be perfect, and they're actually so imperfect that they just they don't want to admit it. So it would seem then that in order to write, you have to not just present yourself as perfect, and that's actually dishonest. You have some burning issues and or doubts and problems, and you don't write any of that. You just write some official letter. Look up in the Bhagavatam how somebody might write a letter to his guru, like one of the prayers, copy the prayer of Lord Brahma or something. But you have to just come in as you are, but keeping in mind that it is a spiritual relationship, and I am foolish, but I am seeking spiritual advice. So not that you come as a fool and then just stay like approaching in a material way to do something that is not his responsibility to deal with or to condone. And of course, we're writing, there should be some idea that of submissiveness. But still, even if it isn't all there, it's good to keep communication. So I guess I'm saying honesty is very important, more important than form. Keep a good form. It's not like that there's a school of how to write business letters, and it must be like this and it should be like this. So someone who knows will say, oh, this person has not written the proper business letter. This address is not correct. They haven't read the margins right. They haven't listed things. You don't read a letter like that. You just see, is it honest? Is there some sincerity? What is the person asking? So that's more important than any form. Just give it a try. And don't be afraid to fail. That's like that awkwardness. We do fail when we present ourselves to the spiritual master. But it's better than not doing it, than trying to keep an imaginary perfect relationship that he thinks of me like this. Or we may feel the opposite, that my spiritual master, he doesn't like me. He doesn't even know who I am, or at least he doesn't like me. So why should I write to him? It will just aggravate that condition. So that's like an over-negative. And the other one is like some imaginary thing that I'd like him to think that I'm perfect. And so the less he knows about me, there's more chance that I can keep that image. But it's just like a make-believe thing that has no substance. The spiritual master is not a mind reader. He's not omniscient. So he doesn't know what's going on there. Therefore, better to get into the reality of it, which is actually progressive. And we know that any little thing, whenever there's little devotion, that's attractive to Krishna and to the spiritual master. So when we do have some devotional sentiments and practices, if we're not afraid to mention them, even if we think they're small, if I don't have something big to report, then that will also be attractive. And it will be a basis for a further discussion. Okay, here's a more philosophical one. Should we see Krishna more in the mode of awe and reverence, or as a cowherd boy playing the flute and sporting in the groves of Vrindavan? In the Bhagavad Gita 9.12, it is said that if one sees the face of Krishna, one should take bath in the Ganges to rid himself of infection. Most of the books depict Krishna as a young boy or youth, and this I find very attractive. So, first of all, in the purport, Prabhupada doesn't say that if you see the face of Krishna, you should take a bath. That sounds like the what we hear about the Jewish religion, that the name of God is so sacred that you can't say it. Or I don't know what it sounds like, that you think Krishna is something bad. But it says here, one who considers the body of Krishna to be material should be driven out from all rituals and activities of the Shruti, and if by chance one sees his face, one should at once take bath in the Ganges to rid himself of. So it's not Krishna's face that shouldn't be seen, but the person who thinks that Krishna has a material body. Rather, we should want to see Krishna's face. Now, which is better, in the mode of awe and reverence, or Krishna playing the flute? It's not just all one, but I'll give you a couple of quotes. Prabhupada says, one should concentrate his mind upon Krishna, the very form with two hands carrying a flute, the bluish boy with a beautiful face and peacock feathers in his hair. There are descriptions of Krishna found in Brahma Samhita and other literatures. One should fix his mind on this original form of Krishna. One should not even divert his attention to other forms of the Lord, such as Narayan, Vishnu, Rama, etc. So, this is certainly our worshipable deity is Krishna, not even Narayan or the impersonal or any other concept. But then, to understand the nature of that cowherd boy and how he's not just an ordinary boy, as Lord Brahma thought when Brahma saw Krishna eating lunch, we have descriptions of the greatness of Krishna. To think of the greatness of God, you don't have to go to Narayan or a Christian or a Muslim concept of God as unknowable. But that cowherd boy, he himself is inconceivable personality of Godhead. He's the most powerful form of God. So in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that he's going to tell some of his opulences, his greatness, to Arjuna. And Prabhupada says, these are some of the opulences of the Supreme Lord. When one is firmly convinced of them, he accepts Krishna with great faith and without any doubt, and he engages in devotional service. All this particular knowledge is required in order to increase one's interest in the loving devotional service of the Lord. One should not neglect to understand fully how great Krishna is, for by knowing the greatness of Krishna, one will be able to be fixed in sincere devotional service. In order to appreciate the sweetness of Krishna, we have to also know that he's great. He's not an ordinary boy. But ultimately, the sweetness or of his activities is what we really want. And that's so. Your attraction like that is good. And there's a statement by Krishna himself that's in the words of Krishnadas Kaviraj. Krishna's viewpoint towards worship. He says, "Everywhere in the world, people worship me according to scriptural injunctions. But simply by following such regulative principles, one cannot attain the loving sentiments of the devotees in Brajabhumi. Knowing my opulences, the whole world looks upon me with awe and veneration, but devotion made feeble by such reverence does not attract me." So this is the confidential expression of the worshipable. The worshipable Krishna, he says, I like this kind of worship, where the devotees just, where they actually love me and want to please me in my own Vrindavan activities. Oh, here's one I'd like to answer. How important is deity worship? Is it advisable for all householders to keep deities, and what standard should be adopted? I have pictures on my altar. Is this equivalent to Krishna in three dimensions? So, specifically, pictures are good, especially as like a preliminary. You can do everything with a picture that you can do with a deity almost. But deity worship is important for householders especially, and especially when they're not living in the temple. So whether it's just so we can take deity to mean pictures also, but to have an altar, perhaps that's a better word than deity, because deity we may think of we have to have a big marble deity or something. But an altar, a worshipable altar, which we tend to, which is like the center of the home, and we chant in front of it, we offer our food there, and the children have to treat it as a sacred place. Or even a room, this is very important. And I have a statement by Prabhupada. I've always appreciated this over the years, so as soon as I saw this question, I thought of this purport, Second Canto, Chapter 3, Text 22. Sukadeva says, the eyes which don't look of Vishnu are like the eyes of a peacock, eyes that can't really see. So Prabhupada says, especially for the household of devotees, the path of deity worship is strongly recommended. As far as possible, every householder, by the direction of the spiritual master, must install the deity of Vishnu, forms Radha Krishna, Lakshmi Narayan, Sitaram. It goes on with different possibilities of forms you could worship. Recommended, one's family should worship strictly following the directions of Archanavidhi. Any member of the family who is above 12 years of age should be initiated by a bona fide spiritual master, and all the members of the householder should be engaged in the daily service of the Lord, beginning from morning, 4 a.m., till night, 10 p.m., by performing artiks. Engagement in such worship of the deity under the direction of a bona fide spiritual master will greatly help the householders to purify. Then he says, simple theoretical book knowledge is not sufficient for a neophyte devotee. Book knowledge is theoretical, whereas the archana process is practical. Because you have to use your body, your hands, to wash and dress, not just to think about. Only attention engaged in the service of the Lord, especially in dressing and decorating the temple, accompanied by musical kirtan and instructions, can save the common man from the hellish cinema attractions and rubbish sex songs broadcast everywhere by radios. So you have to, it's like a make a choice. If you don't have the deity worship, he's saying you'll probably have this instead. Instead of an altar, you'll have a television altar and all this. If one is unable to maintain a temple at home, he should go to another's temple where all the above performances are regularly executed. So this indicates, it seems, but the language in this sentence, that he ought to have a temple at home. But if he's not able to do that, then he should visit a temple. So especially, this is for households, this is always for everybody. We say, well, there are reasons for especially householders. One might be that the householder is more likely to get into the sense gratification and the nonsense entertainments. But the other is, a positive one, that the householder has a place. With a sannyasi, he can't worship the deity. He's going from place to place. He has no schedule. But to do it really nicely. So if I have a home means it's settled and I'm trying to make it nice. So much concentration to improving it. Well, that's perfect to put Krishna there. When I was in England before coming here, I went with the temple president. They're culturing one of the richest men in the world, a Hindu man there. And he has, even in the middle of London, he has a fabulous big house with many, many rooms. And it was like a palace to go in there, and all mirrors and everything. So we were going to take lunch, and he said, you offer this lunch to the deity for me. So we went, going through this maze. It was like that, or the temple president said it's like the description of that, whose house was it? In Yudhisthira's house, it's all mirrors and everything, and water, and looks like land, and Duryodhana fell down. So it was like that, all this maze of rooms, this wing, that wing. And then, where is the deity? We went to one place, after rows and rows of rooms, and within the hall, in a little closet, that's where the deity was. Couldn't even have a room, all he had was a closet. If you have a flat, if you can give the deity a closet, that you're doing all right. Prabhupada used to do that when he traveled with Radha Krishna deities, he would make the closet into a... But I saw that this person had so many rooms, he could have... So many in-laws and daughters and sisters, they probably all had their own room and servants, but... And in that one closet, of course, all the gods... Had to, they're all big Ganesh and Krishna and all the Vishnus are all crowded together. So house means it's you're trying to beautify it and live nicely. So Krishna should have a nice place to worship, and then everything can be purified there. It's like a temple, the whole house. So that's a nice question about deity worship. Any comments on it, or questions on these things?
Yeah. Just on this reading in the Prabhupada lectures in the Bhagavad Gita. Just maybe you could tell me. When Prabhupada answered this question, just on the point you're talking about Krishna, to look in the face of Krishna, with that type of question, you know, that you should take a bath. Uh-huh. And I think said yes, and someone said to Prabhupada, you said it, or not with the side of the thumb. Uh-huh. And does that mean we go to the spiritual world? Krishna reduce himself so we can associate together like this. So I just wanted to maybe you could throw some light on, but it probably just goes yes. Didn't say anything else. And then some other devotees straight after that said we're 10,000 the tip for her.
Yeah.
And does that mean that Krishna shrinks himself down so we can all, you know, reciprocate? And probably just goes yes. So there's no prayer for it or anything after it.
Well, yeah, it's hard to say how the communication was really going there in the class. But according to the science of bhakti, Krishna has a middle-sized form in Vrindavan, like a young boy. He grows up to adolescence like a human. He's not a human, but it's human-like. And so that's his form in Vraj or in Vaikuntha. And so we get our spiritual body is like that. It's not one 10,000th of a portion. That's the spark of the jiva who has expanded around that, a particular material body according to his karma. So when he goes to the spiritual world, Prabhupada, I heard him say that as in this material world, the tiny spirit soul has expanded into the body of an elephant or a human being. So when you go to the spiritual world, the spiritual spark expands or transforms into a spiritual body according to your relationship with Krishna, whatever that may be. And that body is all spiritual. So the that answers that question. Whether in the Vaikuntha or Krishna Loka, it's the size of the thumb, or this, or proportionate to the one to the tiny, tiny spirit soul. No. And as far as the super soul question, I don't know where it is in print, but I have this impression that Prabhupada said I could find it. Well, Prabhupada has written that's an expression. Even the 1/10,000th of the hair, it's just an expression to express it's so tiny that you can't see it. Some of these things, they're just like that. They're inconceivable, or they're spiritual. But to understand them, some material calculation is given. For example, we say that the spiritual world is 3/4 and the material world is 1/4. Prabhupada said, it's not really like that. It's like the spiritual world is many, many, many times bigger than the material world, but just to give you some idea that it's much bigger. Each spiritual planet, in fact, is infinite. So how can you, there's no math to deal with that. So we say the size of the thumb for a human being, because then otherwise you could say, but there's a spirit soul in the ant, how could the Paramatma be the size of the thumb, or the human thumb in an ant? So then it would have to be something proportionate to that in the ant's body. For further information, see Sadaput. I can't answer all these questions that start to really mix the material nature and in a scientific way with the spiritual. They ultimately don't mix, but he's quite expert in explaining these things, so that it does, there's some correlation between material reality and language that we use it here and the spiritual. Yes, it must be strange to see that in print. It Prabhupada just says yes, yes. Or why not? I'm using up most of our time. Let me see if I have any questions. So I can please get some more. I have one here I haven't looked at. I'm going to save that. And I just about answered all the questions, so dealt with them anyway. I have a, just a few others. Yeah.
When Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, on this path there's no loss or diminution, we seem to generally apply that to Krishna consciousness, that the spirit soul becomes conscious of its position in relation to Krishna as an eternal servant. And when he does that, to whatever degree, he makes eternal advancement and gets out of the cycle of birth and death. Eventually, anyway, at some point,
yeah.
He's not going around and around eternally in the through the 8,400,000 species. So, does this also apply to other religions that they would make eternal advancement?
That's a very important and encouraging statement by Krishna. It means that any genuine act of devotion, which could even be just a favorable thought, or you chant God's name, which could be Hare Krishna or another name of God, any act of devotion, it's put in your permanent account. And then, at the time of death, you haven't perfected your life, so you take another body, but whatever you did, it never suffers loss or diminution. That's what that means. And so you build up and you build up, so eventually you can go back to Godhead. So, in previous lives, I may have been in this religion or that religion, but either by the guidance of that religion or just by Krishna's mercy in my heart, I did some pure act of bhakti. So certainly you get credit in whatever religion you practice as long as there's some bhakti done there. Because we recognize that bhakti exists in the great world religions. We just say that it's most developed in Krishna consciousness. We don't say it's not present. And therefore, certainly, this is that verse applies, that whatever they've done, they don't suffer loss, or that's always permanent. From our point of view, Krishna consciousness point of view, we could say that someone who was saintly practicing a particular religion, one result might be that in his next life, he practices Krishna consciousness, Gaudiya Vaishnavism. And that must be true in our case to some degree, that we weren't always Gaudiya Vaishnavas, but we practiced some God consciousness, and now we can come to this God consciousness.